Hello, this is Sean Gaylord, and this is another episode of the Principal Liner Notes podcast. And I am a bit of a fanboy right now because I have whom I consider to be the Beatles of podcasting, and that is Dr. Rod Berger. Rod and I go back a few several years.
Several years, yeah.
I am very honored, Rod, to have you here, where you are going to just we're going to create our own White Album Abbey Road moment.
Okay.
Pressure's
I'm
on you.
game.
Yeah.
I'm game. Well, I so appreciate being included. I've always thought so highly of you. You embody, there's an energy about you that I have no doubt that your staff and students, current and former, that they would be able to just shake their head and say, I know exactly what you mean. There's an energy about you. There's a light that I think is, you know it when you see it, especially in school leadership. And when it's not there, you feel that vacuum, that sort of cold air that runs down the back of your spine. And it's the exact opposite with you. So I am a fanboy as well because it's probably, I don't know if it's the dad in me or it's the person that's interviewed and spent time with so many school leaders at all levels, really through K through university. And yeah, I was saying to you off air, I just love your passion. And it's so great because I don't know if we have passions like we've had in the past. Everything is so minute by minute, and we pivot and we move and we share something different. And people think about you and they just go, you know, I know the group that he loves most. I know what's running through his veins right now. You know what I mean? And that's just, it's really refreshing. It's like a nice break. Whenever I see your post, I just pause for a second, check it out. And I may not even know the reference, but I picture you just smiling, going, there was a moment where you were just thinking about your Beatles and, you know, it just,
Yeah.
you felt compelled to post.
Oh man, thank you. That you kind of nailed that, Rod. So I'm very honored by that. And you know, speaking of passions, I know that one of the things besides your Detroit Tigers is that you are extremely passionate about storytelling. And it is an art that in my estimation has never gone away. It's always there. But you put an illumination on that in the thread of your work, in the thread of this kind of Rod Berger canon that kind of goes throughout, whether it is through your various podcasting exploits, the freelance things that you do, the things that you've done with different networks and entities. So I guess where I want to start is why that illumination? Why Rod Berger illuminating stories in the way that you do?
So the first thing I thought of, and I've never put this together. This is what I love. Maybe we're gonna create something here today, Sean. I talk in the book, and I start off with it. And thank you. This is an exciting time for my book, which is coming out in bookstores on. I'll do my little plug, November
Yes,
12th.
please.
But pre-orders, you can go ahead and pre-order wherever books are sold, or you can go to my website at drrodberger.com/book. And I appreciate the support because I want to tell more stories. You know, it's so interesting. So the first chapter, I talk about my father who grew up in Nazi Germany, and I won't give away the way that I talk about that and sort of the, I don't know, it's a little bit of a cliffhanger just in my own mind and the experience that I had, and I hope that comes across and when people read it.
Does.
But, you know, there was something, right? So he was a much older father, and he was a classic German. I can say this because I'm first generation, so not that I'm going to offend Germans across the board. But there was a distance, there was a and maybe an unintentional coldness from a father-son relationship, but yet I revered him because I knew that he had survived the war. There was a this sort of strand of heroism that he sure didn't project, but I projected upon him just in the little bit that I knew. As you were saying that, it made me think about, you know, I share in there when he first started talking to me about the war and what his story was, because he hadn't shared it with anybody. But what's so interesting is he traveled a lot for work. He was gone all the time. And I hadn't thought about this. I would have written about it, Sean. I would have written about this in the book. But whenever he would come home, I remember I always wanted to be in his bedroom while he was unpacking, and I would just hit him with questions because he would travel all around the world. Now, the thing is, I don't know if I got one answer out of all those years of questioning him. He didn't talk about it, even though it was work. I was never told, oh, you were in Africa or you were in Barcelona, like wherever you were. He was all over the place. He never shared stories with me. I mean, I just remember that. I mean, I can picture his folding, his luggage that was big in the 80s. I can picture that because he would lay that down on the bed, start unpacking, and he would just like, he didn't have time for me in that way. I don't take it that it was mean or disparaging, but it's just he didn't have the language or the mechanism to be able to then translate to me at the age that I was in that very moment. But I was so curious. I wanted to know more, right? And so that's probably where I would then think about what his life was like, you know. It's always been in me. It is to this day. If I, after this podcast, go somewhere and I just start, I mean, I love to talk to people all over the place. You know, I was in Dubai last year. I was included. It was very humble to be included in a book called Voices of the Future as a voice of the future for storytelling. And I ended up walking around. One day I wanted to go to the Persian Gulf. Why? I don't know. Maybe it was the Gulf War. Like, I'm right there. I want to put my feet in the Persian Gulf, in that water. And side story here, I foolish me, total Westerner, didn't think about the heat in June in Dubai. So I just figured, like anybody, like if I was in Santa Monica or in the Jersey Shore, I'd just take my shoes off and walk on the sand. You know, why is nobody laying out on the sand? Well, I know why. You know, if you want to fry an egg or put a rack of ribs down. I've never burned my feet so bad. But I made it and was able to stand in the Persian Gulf. But I remember walking around and I ran it. There was a woman, and it was like this abandoned, it was like a Universal City Walk. If anyone's ever been to either Orlando or in LA. And it was amazing. I'm like, where is everybody? Well, Dubai's it changes like what feels like every day. And developers went, oh, we want to do something different here. So they shut it all down. So it still looked pristine, right? But they had a security guard. Well, this woman just happened to be from Uganda. And I had been to Uganda several times. And it was like, I wanted to get to know her story. That's me. I want to talk to the TSA agent. You know, good, bad, or indifferent, I'm sure that there have been times where people have been thinking, why? Why is this guy curious about my life? And you know what? It's an addiction. It's a drug because once you go down that path and you find out, you know, Sean is really interesting beyond what I see at school. You know what I mean? It's that notion of what is, oh, I saw my principal at the movie theater. That is incredible. What was he doing there? You know, I don't know if kids today still have that feeling, but I just love to learn about the nuggets of life that we don't often share.
Wow. And that in many ways, you know, echoes throughout your book, which I was so happy on lots of levels because I do champion you and champion your work and what you do for humanity, capital H. You know, the Narrative Edge is coming out. It is available. I will put all of the links in the show notes. It will be available for pre-ordering. And I think once you announce I made the announcement, I already pre-ordered it, man. And
Thanks, buddy.
I look forward to having that on the shelf. But I've also done a bit of previewing of the book. And may I,
Please.
if you don't mind, I would like to just the first paragraph in your introduction is so powerful. And it's something. May I read it?
Please.
Okay. I have to take the glasses off. 55-year-old eyes here. The irony of story is that while we live in an ongoing tale we call our life, we sometimes struggle to acknowledge the film strip unfurling right in front of us. We know that story and stories are important. When we pull up a bar stool or chair for a first date, we activate the best face forward stories we can think of to make a hopefully positive impression. And it, I mean, as a former English teacher, you know, just so many great, the thing about your book is that there are so many great hooks and just vivid hooks in your book. And I mean, my God,
I appreciate that. Look, here's what I would say. People will ask me about why I write, how I think about writing, or just storytelling. And then when I speak to when I've when I speak to kids or young people or early, sort of college students, I'm not even I'm a like you'd mentioned my Detroit Tigers, right? I'm a sports fanatic. All my Detroit teams. I didn't play baseball, but I sure love watching playoff baseball, and I love the notion of having an at bat. And so everything, so now when you go back through and you think about things, and we were talking off air about just different experiences that I've had, I consider those, Sean, each one of those is an at bat. Sometimes I fouled the ball off several times. Sometimes I struck out. Sometimes I hit it out of the park. But with each at bat, the baseball slows down. And so why is that important in what you're talking about? For me, it's so that I don't unintentionally roll over an element that defines the person in front of me, or is a core principle of their moral fiber. Because that to me is what's interesting. I always, when people will reach out to me to, whether it's, can you ghostwrite something for us, or interview us, or help us write a book on the, these sorts of things, I always say to them, look, if it's in a press release, I'm not going to talk about it. Like, I'm just not going to do that. That's not interesting to me. I can tell people to go check out a press release about what you're doing. But I'm not going to ask questions based on that, because to me, that's, I use the term lazy, and I don't mean it as pejoratively as it sounds, but it's just that we should be interested in people, right? And so that's why when I've worked, I worked almost 2 decades with Vanderbilt's Business School, working on the power really of story and business for young people. And I would talk to them about this notion that if I take away your title, how do you communicate your value? If you can't walk into a room and say, I'm Principal Sean, you're Sean, community member. How do I understand your value? Is it important to you that I understand your value? Because it makes you reorient the way in which you project and communicate who you are and what you stand for. And so for me, it's all about whatever writing, however people will either like or judge my writing. To me, that this is where it ties, actually. This is where it ties to your love of music. I find that the books that I enjoy reading, or even the people that I listen to, because I listen to countless podcasts of all shapes and sizes, there's a rhythm. I'm not saying it's a song, but there's a rhythm when, and in literary circles, they talk about finding your voice. That that's the hardest thing for people who want to write a book. Like, what's your voice? And my translation to that is, am I writing for you, or am I writing for me? And if I'm writing for me, I'm within my voice. And I'm not then concerned about doing what I think you are either expecting or you want me to do. Now, that lesson for me, I wish I would have learned it much earlier, but it didn't hit me until I was actually landing in Dakar, Senegal. As the plane was approaching and I'm looking down at this landscape I've never seen, it's the first time I'm going to be on the continent. That's when I said to myself, something hit me, and I just said, why, like with all my Forbes writing and everything in the past, I just thought, I need to write like what I'm seeing and experiencing, because I think that's what the reader or the listener is going to, that's what they're going to gravitate towards. The facts are the facts, right? We can, but they're going to gravitate and maybe be more interested in those data points because of the connection. And so I did. I was sort of, I cut the umbilical cord at that point, and I just said, I'm going to, and so I did that on that trip. I started basically journaling on Facebook, and I got incredible responses from people I'd never met before in my life. So it's about at bats to me. It's about understanding that you can't please everybody, but if I'm going to do my job in the way that I like to tell stories and weave in, I mean, my hope, Sean, is that as you've been reading it, that you walk away from a chapter going, well, he took me to, we went to Rome, then we went to suburban Detroit, then we went to Northern Michigan, we went to LA, and then we ended up on a stage with a civil rights leader, That to me is, I'm hoping, a fun deep dive for people, that where they can't really peg what's going to be on the next page if I've done my job right.
You you have so eloquently, and to kind of take this to the lens of school leadership, because I encourage school leaders to step outside their comfort zone and to read things that you would not necessarily, well, to read first of all, but to read things that you would not normally pick up off the education shelf. I think it's really important, to kind of widen your scope and to look at things beyond the schoolhouse, and then to find those connections. But very often in school leadership circles, Rod, we are held to data. We are held to high stakes testing. We are held to those things, and there is a time and a place for that, and there is a time and place to be that kind of leader. But I also find that principals and assistant principals and folks in school leadership struggle within that tension between that data-driven leader and then that human-centered leader. So I'm wondering how, your wisdom, your insight in terms of helping principals navigate through that tension between, hey, you got to get test scores up, but then you also have to build the culture, and you have to connect with people. As my friend Todd Whitaker says, it's the people, not the programs. So how can storytelling, and maybe some of the things in the Narrative Edge book be kind of a salve or an oasis for school leaders to kind of reconcile themselves within that tension?
Great question. The first thing I think about, in the book I talk about, I love thinking about story in reference to characters and sort of old school plays, if you think about it, when we were young. And it's, hey, Sean, what part did you get? And you're like, well, I'm the oak tree, or I'm the leading character, I'm the main character, or a supporting character. I've got three lines. There's so many things that I'm thinking about just from your question, but there's this notion to me of, and I ask in the book, it's, what character do you play in your own story? Are you the main character? And if not, why? Are you a supporting character? And is that your Mount Rushmore? Maybe it is. I know a gentleman, a very successful entrepreneur in Stockholm, and he is at his best when he is second and supporting an idea and a dream. That's just his lane where he can function. And for him, that's his feeling of the main character. And it's not about aspiring to be a main character, but I do find in the principals that I have known, those that I have gravitated to, and also for superintendents, those that to me have an understanding that at some point in time during a school year or during when you're thinking big picture about your career, have you taken the time to sit in different seats within the audience? Because if you haven't, try it. Right? Are you in the front row? What's that experience like? What's it like when you're in the back corner? Because I think it changes the way in which you communicate with your folks. It helps you understand, it allows you to understand and pick up. It's like if you hear a new song that's being laid down and you go, we're missing something. I don't know what it is. It's like cooking a meal and you think, did we, is it, do we not, do we need more salt? Like, it doesn't have to be something big, but it's about frame. It's like I remember a conversation I had with my kid's principal, who's since retired and personally a very lovely woman. But the culture at that school was really backsliding. And I had known a number of staff members and department heads, and you could just, I got a sense, and maybe I was lucky because I was getting behind the scenes kind of data points, if you will, or narrative data points. And I called her because they started stripping away extracurriculars. And my son was doing very well in math and science at the time, and they took all of these things away that he had just loved doing because he would be pulled out to be have these extra experiences. All the while we're in the stated number one district in the state of Tennessee. And I just wanted to have a conversation with her. And her response to me was, I remember it, Dr. Berger, Heath is getting, Heath Berger is getting all A's, top marks. He's fine. He's fine. And that rang through my head like sort of the worst bell, ringing through the city streets or something like that on a cold, dark night. I said to her, I said, well, I don't know if that's the point of education, because as a third grader, if we stay on this track, he's probably going to be disengaged around fifth grade. And we're all going to wonder why, because he has the aptitude, the capacity, the comprehension for feeding the beast mentality. And it said so much to me. It wasn't just then that I became an angry parent at all. It was, wow, there really is something going on culturally at that school. And it sounds like it's probably outside the realm of what can be controlled within that building. So one, I had empathy for her and what she was going through, because there were some more systemic issues throughout the district. But I do think that it required, and I think she was kind of forced into the audience a little bit. And that was part of the struggle for her, because I did like her personally quite a lot. But I do think we, in any situation, whether it's a school or it's a startup, we're so used to wanting to find our spot. It's like, this is why so many startups, you get like a 22-year-old and they start a company, and he reaches out to me and says, will you do a story on me? I'm a CEO. It's like, okay, I appreciate. I'm not saying we're playing house here, but I love the chutzpah, the confidence. I love all of that. But this notion that with the title comes some level of expectation and a way in which we should be treated, that just says to me that culturally we're struggling to honor people for their individuality, allow for a sense of independence and agency. And I think that does bleed over, sadly, into our school systems, where, we're getting pulled in so many directions. And it's like you almost have to be what I would imagine as a principal, the main character on the stage. But boy, watch good Dead Poets Society. Get a refresher. Be Ethan Hawke and struggle to stand up on that desk when Robin Williams challenges all the boys to do that. And it's not about moving desks, it's about changing your perception, because it might impact the story with which you want to tell within that school.
Yes.
And I had spent time with a principal on the Tennessee-Kentucky border a few years ago. She was the exact opposite in that she was audience first. Everything about her was she sat in the audience. And you know what the vibe in that school was? Unbelievable. Most people say, would you want to go back and be, let's say, 12 again or whatever? And you say, no way. I know too much. It's too exhausting. Her energy was so inclusive, where the staff walked around and felt like they were the students in the most, in the best possible way. They were as enthused as the students. And that to me, and by the way, a side note, I'd never seen so much artwork on the walls in a school. And it, but that subtlety, you talk about a change. It's like the ambiance in a restaurant. You go, I don't know what it is. I don't even know if the food is the best food, but I feel something when I cross the threshold into that establishment. And that school was absolutely that. There was, it was like a 10 to 1 ratio of like stuff you have to put up because the state of Tennessee says you have to, or, the rules of what. It was the exact opposite. It was artwork, and it wasn't by grade. I mean, it was just like, we are a community. And that to me, like if I had to say who embodies someone who's sitting in the audience for the best reasons, because they want to feel all of that. They want that three-dimensional sound. They want to hear the bass. They want to feel it. It was her.
As you say that, Rod, and I'm getting chills, because there are so many ways for leaders in any role to influence and leverage story. And I think a big part of that, when you mentioned the school with the artwork, I mean, that is telling a story. What do you want the story to be transmitted from the things that are hanging on the walls? What story do you want to write when you are? Because I've done that move too, where I've done a whole faculty meeting, sitting in the back, or sitting at the Island of Misfit Toys table to kind of elucidate a point. What it's not necessarily, and I think school leaders have been damaged by this notion of what we talked about earlier about followers, hashtags, the staged selfie, or the abundance of selfies. And again, there is a time and place for those kinds of things. I mean, that is the PR world that we do live in terms of digital media and school leaders. We can't ignore that. We have to use it. People subscribe to that, and we have to honor the path that people take to get information about our schoolhouse or about our school vision or organization or whatever it may be. But I also think there's this kind of localized gravel level storytelling that we miss. And in terms of when people walk into your classroom or when people pull up, they have literally opened the pages of your story. They've literally opened the pages of your book. And that's purposeful why I brought up the introduction, because people tend to skip over that. I want to get to chapter one. No, there's there's some stuff there that Rod lays down for you that you need to open up to. So I think let's build on that just a little bit. Let's go down that
Okay.
rabbit hole of the kind of levels of storytelling that school leaders or any leader need to be kind of open to and to tune into.
One of the things that jumps to my mind is it's like I would say to I'll take it from the professor or the teacher perspective. As you start to matriculate through school, there are those moments I think that most people have, maybe not all, where there's that thought in your mind, maybe something didn't go your way as a student, and you just think, did that teacher, like, were they just born as a teacher? Like, did they not struggle or see that there was, these things could happen? Because you're wanting to, and really that's a desire to find the human in that individual, that professional. And sometimes I'm surprised when you have an environment like a school and you're a principal. I would think something very natural would be that does my school know my own story? And I would, and I have so many principals that are dear friends of mine, but I would struggle to name five, let alone 10, that I would put money down that the staff and the students know their story. Because it's interesting, students pick up on this. You can read the tea leaves, right? You can read a room in a way where you think, all right, that administrator is putting on the great face because this is a formal event or experience that the parents are coming to, and the kids pick up on it right away. So when they invoke we as a school, it just doesn't, it lands really flat with the students. But boy, if you get a student body, and I mean even at the elementary level, that feels like that principal, like I just, there's something about them. Right. And there are different levels of that connectivity based on sort of growth, maturity emotionally. But boy, if I was a principal tomorrow, I would want to make sure that my entire community in that building, that campus, they knew my story. Not because it's about propping up my story at all, but it's to say, I haven't always had it figured out. I don't have it figured out right now. But what I do know is we are going to figure this out together. We're going to have teachers that end up getting married this year, and maybe someone has a baby, and we get a new student from another country. Like, this is what enriches our community. And I'm not even saying you have to share your story, but boy, if that's a part of sort of your ethos, I think that that changes the way in which you interact with people. I think it impacts the energy when you go into a department meeting. I think it impacts when you're sitting there in a homeroom where your homeroom teacher's like, I think if that's the approach and people know your story, they are much more receptive to wanting to understand why you're making the decision you're making, as opposed to this top-down approach. So I hope that doesn't rub people the wrong way. That's not the intention. It's just, have we thought about that? Because to me, if there's ever an environment where it actually would be strategically really smart to have that notion of, do they know my story? I would tell me this, Sean, not to flip the thing here and I'm interviewing you, but
That's
I
fine.
would be shocked to think that your, at least your staff don't know about your love of the
It's pretty evident. Down
Beatles.
to my tie clip, down to if you walk into my office, it's pretty evident the music I listen to.
And
And
so the proof there, Sean, is that story can be expressed in so many ways. This is not about, oh, well, does it mean that I have to be good in front of a microphone or good in front of a group? Not at all. You tell stories, and there's a story that I reference in the book about a young person back in my mental health days that I worked with that he was as quiet. He was the prototypical quiet student. And I remember the social worker, whenever she would drop him off and then we would be done, she'd want to talk with me or whatever. And it was just, this kid would never say a word. And I found out that the teachers didn't even know his name. But you know what? That young person, every day of school, and even 7 days a week, would wear, I won't say the color, let's just say he was a fan of a certain school, and that school has a very bright color. And that young man would wear that, those, you know, their swag, right, every day. And yet no one knew his story on the surface because he didn't talk. The teachers did. He was just a number. He was in a lesson plan. He was in a grade book. That was really it. And yet he was screaming out from the inside and letting you know, I've got an easy conversation starter. You know, hey, Jimmy, I see you're a fan of, I'm going to go out on a limb and think you're a fan of this school, right? And it's not to be trite about that, but that young man was communicating a story in a way that he felt comfortable in that chapter of his life. And the adults in his environment were not picking up on the cues. So you do not have to be a public speaker. You don't have to like being in front of people. You don't even have to be a good writer. I've been asked that as well. Not at all. We communicate stories the minute, if we're in a bad mood, that communicates a story. When you walk into a meeting and you think, oh, well, can't wait to interact with Sean today. He looks real happy. So that's just what I think of. I think about that young man, especially in the educational setting, where you think we're so attuned to the loud, to the one that's loud in there, or is disruptive, or that is loud in a way that just says they're contributing. They're making my life as an educator or an administrator easier because they're so prepared. They're the grease to the wheel of today's lesson. Great, good, that's valuable, but let's look at this as a tapestry and understand what else is being communicated in that room.
That's amazing. And that's a key point, Rod, that story, we sometimes equivocate storytelling with bravado and charisma and performance. And yes, there is a level of that. There is an art to that, and there are folks that make livings off that. I think about our stand-up comedians. I think about podcasters. Who have a certain large multi-million follower base. But then I think about. If we were to strip it away and if we were to go back all the way to ancient Greece and sit around the campfire with Homer and him talking about the Iliad and the Odyssey, and they probably didn't even he didn't even call it that. It was just, hey, let's talk about the story of when these guys fought over this beautiful woman. Let's talk about this guy that couldn't get home, and then as he passed that on, it evolved into these epics. Same thing with Abraham Lincoln. Probably, he, probably not a bravado person, but a very humble person, and but somehow he could captivate and can compel people with his storytelling. Very, very simple truths, very, very simple, Honest Abe, right?
That's right.
And it and Homer and Lincoln are kind of seen as the template for excellence when it comes for storytelling.
It's so true. But it's also something I think to remind ourselves of. Even, as moms and dads or business owners or employees or community members, you can get you, it's the pause, right? It's the, I always like to talk about it. It's the elevator stopping between two floors. Not always a bad thing.
Yes.
Right? Because it forces you, well, now wait a minute, let me think this through. Am I, like, in essence, what is my motivation? Is it, this is more about me than it's that the kids want to stay up and watch some interesting documentary with me? Like, maybe I need to pause and celebrate that they want that time with dad, and that's where we can learn about everything from history to language and impact on whatever it is. But yet I'm thinking, I've got a podcast with Sean in the morning. I need to get sleep. Like, it does, when you pause like that, it does, I think, force reflection in a way that is, I just think it's good for the spirit, I mean, look, that's the danger of the incredible opportunity I've had to travel around the world. I've said this many times. I do believe I talk about it in the book, but it's like when you return a rental car at the airport. Once you cross those spikes, you can't back up. Once you have taken a dive into story about humans, not fantasy or fairy tale or but you say, wait a minute. I may not know that individual specifically, but I know that, there's a Susan in my life that I know that was referenced. There's a Sean that I know. It's not Sean, but I know Sean, It is something where you just think, I can't go back. I can't look at the strip mall in the same way. I can't hear the complaint from my kids about whatever that, well, they ended up having tacos at school and it just happened to be taco night at the burger house. It's like, guys, I have been to a refugee camp and I have been there on the third Thursday when they get their disbursement of food and cooking oil. And the concept of dignity is flashing in front of your face. Because you do not want to take away the little sliver of dignity that they're desperately clawing and holding on to. It does change you. It does change you. It's really powerful. It's just so addicting.
It is. And your book, as I was reading your book, there were, and again, I don't want to give away too much because it is such a compelling read, but I found that I was Googling certain things after I would read an element. I want to see, when you describe a place, I wanted to, all right, let me Google, this place, or let me look up this person. It really the and that's the thing about your podcast too, is it, and your story and all of that work is it there are these kind of entry points into other worlds and realms that you've kind of illuminated us on. And to me, that's the power of story, right? It's the curiosity that you have feeds the curiosity that I have as audience in wanting to learn more or to dive in more. To me, that's the power of your book, man.
Well, that's so incredibly kind of you. I will say that I've now started, you're going to start to see Narrative Edge as a podcast. I
Nice.
have reoriented. So those of you who have been following me on Headroom, I'm learning from the young people, Sean. I have reoriented my podcast so that it's just the Dr. Rodberger channel. So nothing has changed, but it allows me to put in podcasts from different shows that I host to include now the Narrative Edge in support of the book and getting it out there. So, it and you know I'm st here's what's interesting about that. I'm starting to now go back and revisit people that I interviewed over the past and do a second interview.
Nice.
So like yesterday I interviewed, and I'm really excited about this for the Narrative Edge podcast, but I interviewed Rich Tu, TU. Rich is an incredibly he's an award-winning designer and artist. And he was commissioned, this is public knowledge, but he got a talk about a phone call, right? You get a phone call and an email from FIFA for the World Cup, and they want to see if he's interested. They want to commission him to design the poster for the New York, New Jersey, because each location has its own, and there's a history behind these posters from, the origin of the World Cup. So of course it's that moment of are you kidding me? Absolutely. He's Filipino American. He is so incredibly accomplished. And he it was so fun to go back and to revisit. He had an exhibit in New York called The Human Response. And I'm going to include he's granted me the opportunity to include this 10-minute artistic movie that is just so moving, where he took voicemails from his late father and plugged those in to AI and created the experience of reconnecting with his father.
Oh my God.
It blows you away. And that was so much fun to be able to go back and talk about that and then to apply that notion of driving over the spikes at a rental car. Like it was so moving for him that I wanted to know, like, how did that change him as a storyteller? Like, how does he understand where he is on the stage, right? Is he the son of an immigrant who is basically just taking direction in these corporate artistic pursuits? Or is he Rich Tu, the storyteller that has been now asked? And the poster is absolutely incredible. And I mean, to think that I know this guy who I consider a friend, he's just a creative genius that because New York, New Jersey is where the World Cup final is going to be played.
That's right.
That poster has already been in Times Square. I mean, it's just such a good human. And to think that that story and the weight of having to represent so many cultures, technically two state, I mean, that's just unbelievable to me. So that has given me the opportunity to go back and think about that. And it has, I did this, Sean. So since you pre-ordered it, you hold me to this, but I'm working on a lost chapter. So if people pre-order, once the book comes out, I will send you a lost chapter.
Nice.
Well, there's a lot of pressure on that because it's the elements that I didn't include in the book, not because I didn't think they fit. It's because when I write, it's like, I think it's maybe like jamming and writing a song. I'll sit down and think, this is what I'm going to, my hope for this chapter is, man, something hits me and I go down an entirely different track, or I flip the perspective that I thought I was going to be sort of approaching with my words.
Right.
And I think, wow, okay, I did not see that coming, but it was listening to my movie scores while I write. I'm huge, big fan of movie scores.
Nice.
On repeat too. If I find one, boom, I am Hans Zimmer. Americas is my latest one. Whether I'm working out at the gym or I'm writing, I am, or Interstellar, the Matthew McConaughey movie, Corn Haze, I think it is, Cornfield or something like that. That song
Yes.
is on repeat. So the lost chapter. But Rich reminded me; it's given me an opportunity to revisit people that I'm curious about. I want to go back and see what's happened. And so I'm trying to bring that flavor to the lost chapter. And then look, while we're, and I'm back to you, but I have been asked about writing a companion guide to The Narrative Edge.
Really?
Yeah, by multiple people. And so now that's what I'm working on, so that after the book comes out, maybe within the, sort of 90 days after, the hope is that we'll be able to put that on sale, which is, it'll be a workbook. So what you went through in the book will allow you hopefully to put yourself within those elements.
That's amazing because I'm already, as I'm reading the book and that, I mean, again, just major congratulations on all of the good things that are coming and all of the good things that are to because I see the narrative edge here being, almost a future mastermind or book study for school leaders because I do believe it is something that it's one of those things they do not teach you in principal school. It is one of those things that they do not teach you in a professional development that is targeted towards school leaders. I mean, there's you either have it or you don't, right? And in terms of storytelling. So, but I just see it as such an essential component, an essential tool for not just school leaders, but any leader or anyone wanting to find connection to humanity. That's all of us. So,
Well, it's such a compliment, Sean. I mean, that was my initial dream of it. Really, it was a dream. It was just I didn't want to leave anybody out. I didn't want someone to think, but I'm not a teacher or I'm not an
right.
entrepreneur. I didn't want that. I mean, my hope is that you might pick it up because you're a principal and you heard Sean talk about it, but you finish the book thinking about it as a spouse, as a parent, as a friend, as a family member. Doesn't mean that you lose whatever that was at the initial sort of hook to read the book, but that it allowed you to think, I hope, deeply about the different areas that really make us human. Celebrate the flaws. And I don't even remember the preview that I sent you of what's in there, but this is not a glorified. There are lots of warts that I walk you through, and difficult times that I've had. So it's important. It's important, I think, to honor the audience in doing so. And I am no different. I am no different. I've just been stupid lucky in getting in environments and foolishly curious enough to ask questions that people say, why would you do that? Why would you ask that? I don't know if we have time for this. Do I have time for one more thing that I would love to share?
Absolutely,
So
absolutely.
to that point, Sean, so I didn't intend to do this when I first arrived in Africa the first time, but I was so curious. I've been able to say, this will be one of those memories as the lights are turning off on my life here on Earth. I'd be shocked if it doesn't flash in front of me, which is, I've been so blessed to have had an experience where a young African has seen me in my skin for the first time. You can't put words to that.
No,
And
you
I was
can't.
glad that I didn't know that potentially that could happen when I was in such remote places. But that does change you. And when I had that experience, I really wanted to dive into, I knew I looked different. It's just like, why don't I own it and just know that I'm walking in and I am incredibly different from what they're used to seeing. And so I started to ask, in different parts of Africa, how do you describe a person with white skin? What is there a name or is there a label? And I would be told that. And I then would use that in interactions with villagers. And I would have people that were with me going, oh my gosh, what, I'd be terrified to do that. You know what it did every time, Sean? Not one time did it not, like, I guess work. Maybe that's not really the right word. It dropped walls on my side, their side, and it was like a kinship immediately. Like in West Africa, they would say tubab would be what they would say. Oh, you didn't know that. I don't know what that word would mean, right? Well, that's white face. I mean, that's how they describe it. Mzungu in Eastern Africa. So I'd meet all the, you'd say, I was interviewing a grandmother who every day walks a total of 6 hours to get clean water for her grandchildren because the school has no functioning water. Okay. And it's like their translation and everything. And it's like, Mzungu, just, and it's this like laughing and connection. And then they want to show you where they live. And then I would do it at the airports in these capital cities. And the best, most engaging experiences because I was at least acknowledging I am, you know what I mean? We're the same. This is not, I'm an American or I'm a white male. It was just, and so I don't know if that works for everybody, but boy, I have been the incredible recipient of grace and inclusion and acceptance because I called out what I was without acting as if I either knew better or had a perspective that was above them and their dignity, which they deserved wholeheartedly. So that to me is the power of understanding where we fit in the stories that we live and that we want to live in.
That's so powerful, Rod. That's very moving, my friend. One more question before
Okay.
we go. I'm just
I'm gonna
curious.
sit up straight here. Okay.
How close have you gotten to interviewing Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr? I'm just curious. How close, man? I mean, is that in the queue? Is that going to happen? Will it happen? Do you even want it to happen, man? I don't know.
Oh my gosh, yes. Well, but here's the thing. Early on, people would say to me, especially in the education world, when I started my podcasting, they would say, "Well, why are you interviewing all these different people? Why don't you just focus on science teachers or print, you know?" And I said, "Because it makes me better." I mean, that was really my it makes me better. So I'm open to any and all. So on the music side of it, I have been really sort of again stupid lucky in some of these things. I mean, to interview Sammy Hagar of Van Halen, and I talk about that in the book and that experience with him. That's another example where pause the elevator, because and when I've had those moments where it's someone who's iconically famous around the world, I think, God, they're just humans. And what would I think most people would ask them about their greatest hits or tell me something about the band that no one knows, right? Sort of the basic fodder. We ended up talking about him growing up dirt poor in the lettuce fields of California and his grandfather and a double wide, and how the grandfather had such pride for Italian heritage that he would cook in a way that you thought it was like a five-star restaurant. And Sammy could smell it as he would be walking to his grandfather's trailer. You know, it's that to me. So I've had those experiences. I've had, when it comes to the music scene, a lot of people don't know this, but so much of our music is influenced from the Nordics and especially Stockholm, Sweden. Sharion Studios is like, think of it like Motown. And the music that is influenced by the Swedes, you would be shocked. You would be absolutely shocked the impact that their music has had on us, has had, and currently does have. And I, again, I have,
Beyond
a, yeah, right. But you would never know. I mean, popular music in the American sort of playlist, you would know that underneath that are producers from Sweden, all kind of these great stories. So I got a chance to cover the Dennis Pop Awards. And I was the only one there to do that. And they had me behind the scenes. And I was in Shellback's studio and his drum set. And I was interviewing a gentleman who did the, he actually did the World Cup theme song in the early 2000s. And I was around all of these incredible artists. I mean, unbelievable. Where you just say, I, you know, you would have been a blast to have been with me
And
to do
yeah.
that. And so I've had those kinds of experiences with musicians, but then I've had crazy ones where I am in a black tinted window Tahoe or Yukon behind the scenes at Formula One, and I just happen to be, it's me, Shaggy, Wyclef Jean, and DJ Cassidy, a very, probably the most famous DJ we've got out there, who did, he's the one that did the state call out at the Democratic convention. That was him. And then me. And we were going to the Sports Illustrated party for Formula One. And I just thought, this is the craziest thing ever. So I've seen musicians. I have spent time with Ashley Simpson, who's now coming out with a new album. You know, it's just, but this is for me, it's when you say yes to things and you go, because it gets back to this, they were all at bats. They were all at bats.
Yes.
And I've got something that, knock on wood, is supposed to happen coming up here. Where you may find me on Sir Richard Branson's Necker Island, interviewing from an athlete's perspective. He is a Michael Jordan of his sport. So we'll see. Knock on wood. Send the good vibes. That's what's tentative on the calendar. But the only reason I say that is because, again, it's at bats. It's opportunity just to be able to converse with people who've had different experiences and to understand where do I connect with them. You know, maybe I connect with Magic because we both went to Michigan State. And my first question to him when I didn't know what to ask was, wow, I needed to ask him about the phantom foul in 88 when we lost because they gave a foul.
Right.
Tribute, they gave Bill Laimbeer a foul in the final 3 seconds and Kareem
A
hit two
game.
free throws and we lost. And I was devastated, crying over my frozen pizza. And my, what is it that like the instead of champagne with your kid, like the Welch's bubbly, you know?
Exactly.
Right? I'm sitting there going, this is my first, we're going to win a championship. And that was my first question to him. And it dropped the walls and he just had this incredible laugh. And someone captured it. And it's one of my most favorite pictures of just being human and knowing that if I can just do that, stories will probably unfurl in the way in which you read the introduction earlier.
Yes, absolutely, man. It truly is a the book is a blessing and is going to ignite many blessings and entry points for many readers for years to come. The book is The Narrative Edge. The author is Dr. Rod Berger. It's coming out this November, correct?
In bookstores in November, you can pre-order now because those will get mailed out earlier. Pre-orders, I'm finding out in the business of publishing, and my publishers Wiley, I want to give them a shout out, is incredibly important. And also those that pre-order will get the lost chapter, and we can stay connected in that way too. So I've got a lot more coming, and also the Dr. Rod Berger channel, Apple, Spotify, all of that. And if you're already a Headroom follower, you'll see that automatically. But that's where the Narrative Edge podcasts are coming out. The first one just dropped, but I haven't made the announcement. And I actually have a lasting thing here, Sean. I did a, not to bring politics, but I was asked last year to write a, they called a movie, but a political ad that is much longer than a commercial. They just said, we think your travel around the world, would you do something about that? And I did, and it went viral. And the craziest part was that my phrasing was invoked by Biden before it had gotten transitioned over to Harris, and they do book trailers like movie trailers. And so as we speak, they're wrapping up the I think the third draft of the book trailer for the Narrative Edge. So they're really great people, and they offered to do that for me. And so. Trying to blast it out there in the best way that I can, not about the book, just so that I can continue to capture stories of people that I think we should all know, you know.
Well, Rod, I really appreciate you being here and being on the other end of the microphone, so to
It's
speak.
not easy, Sean. It's not
I
easy.
know, man. I know. I've been there, man. I you know, but nevertheless, truly, truly an honor and truly a gift to have you here on Principal Liner Notes. And I am excited for the impact that the Narrative Edge will make this November. Again, friends, go ahead and pre-order the book. And if you can't wait for the book to land your way, definitely subscribe on your favorite platform, be it Apple or Spotify, to the Dr. Rod Berger channel. It is definitely worthwhile. And if you need a respite from your busy day, if you need something to help you on your commute or to compel you in your workout, Rod is that voice that will remind you of the beauty and the importance of what it means to be human and to be connected through story.
Thank
Rod,
you, Sean. You're one of my favorite humans, sir. Thank you.
likewise, my friend. As I sign off here on the Principal Liner Notes podcast, I do a typical sign off. But I always try to amend it in honor of our guests. So for you frequent listeners, stay with me. Don't turn off, because I do know that the sign off is kind of like my message from me to you, but also including Rod in this. So don't forget to share with the world your dreams and your stories, because your stories help make the world a better place, and the world is better because your story is in it, just like Rod's. This is the Principal Liner Notes podcast. This is Sean Gaylord with my wonderful guest, Dr. Rod Berger. Thank you so much for tuning in, and be sure to share with us your stories. Thank you.